At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Chapter 21 of The Lodger. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Leanne Howlett. The Lodger by Marie Belloc Lowndes. Chapter 21. It was a very cold night. So cold, so windy, so snow-laden was the atmosphere, that everyone who could do so stayed indoors. Bunting, however, was now on his way home from what had proved a really pleasant job. A remarkable piece of luck had come his way this evening, all the more welcome because it was quite unexpected. The young lady at whose birthday party he had been present in capacity of waiter had come into a fortune that day, and she had had the gracious, the surprising thought of presenting each of the hired waiters with a sovereign. This gift, which had been accompanied by a few kind words, had gone to Bunting's heart. It had confirmed him in his conservative principles. Only gentlefolk ever behaved in that way. Quiet, old-fashioned, respectable, gentlefolk, the sort of people of whom those nasty radicals know nothing and care less. But the ex-butler was not as happy as he should have been. Slackening his footsteps, he began to think with puzzled concern of how queer his wife had seemed lately. Ellen had become so nervous, so jumpy, that he didn't know what to make of her sometimes. She had never been really good-tempered, your capable, self-respecting woman seldom is, but she had never been like what she was now, and she didn't get better as the days went on. In fact, she got worse. Of late she had been quite hysterical, and for no reason at all. Take that little practical joke of young Joe Chandler. Ellen knew quite well he often had to go about in some kind of disguise, and yet how she had gone on, quite foolish-like, not at all as one would have expected her to do. There was another queer thing about her which disturbed him in more senses than one. During the last 3 weeks or so, Ellen had taken to talking in her sleep. "No, no, no," she had cried out, only the night before. "It isn't true. I won't have it said. It's a lie." And there had been a wail of horrible fear and revolt in her unusually quiet, mincing voice. Phew! It was cold, and he had stupidly forgotten his gloves. He put his hands in his pockets to keep them warm, and began walking more quickly. As he tramped steadily along, the ex-butler suddenly caught sight of his lodger walking along the opposite side of the solitary street, one of those short streets leading off the broad road which encircles Regent's Park. Well, this was a funny time of night to be taking a stroll for pleasure, like. Glancing across, Bunting noticed that Mr. Sleuth's tall, thin figure was rather bowed, and that his head was bent toward the ground. His left arm was thrust into his long Inverness cape, and so was quite hidden, but the other side of the cape bulged out, as if the lodger were carrying a bag or parcel in the hand which hung down straight. Mr. Sleuth was walking rather quickly, and as he walked he talked aloud, which, as Bunting knew, is not unusual with gentlemen who live much alone. It was clear that he had not yet become aware of the proximity of his landlord. Bunting told himself that Ellen was right. Their lodger was certainly a most eccentric, peculiar person. Strange, was it not, that that odd, loony-like gentleman should have made all the difference to his, Bunting's, and Mrs. Bunting's happiness and comfort in life? Again glancing across at Mr. Sleuth, he reminded himself, not for the first time, of this perfect lodger's one fault. his odd dislike to meat, and to what Bunting vaguely called to himself, sensible food. But there, you can't have everything, the more so that the lodger was not one of those crazy vegetarians who won't eat eggs and cheese. No, he was reasonable in this, as in everything else connected with his dealings with the Buntings. As we know, Bunting saw far less of the lodger than did his wife. Indeed, he had been upstairs only three or four times since Mr. Sleuth had been with them, and when his landlord had had occasion to wait on him, the lodger had remained silent. Indeed, their gentleman had made it very clear that he did not like either the husband or wife to come up to his rooms without being definitely asked to do so. Now, surely, would be a good opportunity for a little genial conversation. Bunting felt pleased to see his lodger. It increased his general comfortable sense of satisfaction. So it was that the butler, still an active man for his years, crossed over the road, and, stepping briskly forward, began trying to overtake Mr. Sleuth. But the more he hurried along, the more the other hastened, and that without ever turning round to see whose steps he could hear echoing behind him on the now freezing pavement. Mr. Sleuth's own footsteps were quite inaudible, an odd circumstance when you came to think of it, as Bunting did think of it later, lying awake by Mrs. Bunting's side in the pitch darkness. What it meant, of course, was that the lodger had rubber soles on his shoes. Now Bunting had never had a pair of rubber-soled shoes sent down to him to clean. He had always supposed the lodger had only one pair of outdoor boots. The two men, the pursued and the pursuer, at last turned into the Marylebone Road. They were now within a few hundred yards of home. Plucking up courage, Bunting called out, his voice echoing freshly on the still air. "Mr. Sleuth, sir, Mr. Sleuth." The lodger stopped and turned round. He had been walking so quickly, and he was in so poor a physical condition, that the sweat was pouring down his face. "Ah, so it's you, Mr. Bunting? I heard footsteps behind me, and I hurried on. I wish I'd known that it was you. There are so many queer characters about at night in London." "Not on a night like this, sir. Only honest folk who have business out of doors would be out such a night as this. It is cold, sir." And then into Bunting's slow and honest mind there suddenly crept the query as to what on earth Mr. Sleuth's own business out could be on this bitter night. "Cold?" the lodger repeated. He was panting a little, and his words came out sharp and quick through his thin lips. "I can't say that I find it cold, Mr. Bunting. When the snow falls, the air always becomes milder." "Yes, sir, but tonight there is such a sharp east wind. Why, it freezes the very marrow in one's bones. Still, there is nothing like walking in cold weather to make one warm, as you seem to have found, sir." Bunting noticed that Mr. Sleuth kept his distance in a rather strange way. He walked at the edge of the pavement, leaving the rest of it, on the wall side, to his landlord. "I lost my way," he said abruptly. "I've been over Primrose Hill to see a friend of mine, a man with whom I studied when I was a lad, and then, coming back, I lost my way." Now they had come right up to the little gate which opened on the shabby, paved court in front of the house, that gate which now was never locked. Mr. Sleuth, pushing suddenly forward, began walking up the flagged path, when, with a "by your leave, sir," the ex-butler, stepping aside, slipped in front of his lodger in order to open the front door for him. As he passed by Mr. Sleuth, the back of Bunting's bare left hand brushed lightly against the long Inverness cape the lodger was wearing, and to Bunting's surprise, the stretch of cloth against which his hand lay for a moment was not only damp maybe from stray flakes of snow which had settled upon it, but wet and gluey. Bunting thrust his left hand into his pocket. It was with the other that he placed the key in the lock of the door. The two men passed into the hall together. The house seemed blackly dark in comparison with the lighted-up road outside, and as he groped forward, closely followed by the lodger, there came over Bunting a sudden, reeling sensation of mortal terror, an instinctive, assailing knowledge of frightful immediate danger. A stuffless voice, the voice of his first wife, the long-dead girl to whom his mind so seldom reverted nowadays, uttered into his ear the words, "Take care." And then the lodger spoke. His voice was harsh and grating, though not loud. "I'm afraid, Mr. Bunting, that you must have felt something dirty, foul, on my coat? It's too long a story to tell you now, but I brushed up against a dead animal, a creature to whose misery some thoughtful soul had put an end, lying across a bench on Primrose Hill." "No, sir, no, I didn't notice nothing. I scarcely touched you, sir." It seemed as if a power outside himself compelled Bunting to utter these lying words. "And now, sir, I'll be saying good night to you," he said. Stepping back, he pressed with all the strength that was in him against the wall, and let the other pass him. There was a pause, and then, "Good night," returned Mr. Sleuth, in a hollow voice. Bunting waited until the lodger had gone upstairs, and then, lighting the gas, he sat down there in the hall. Mr. Sleuth's landlord felt very queer, queer and sick. He did not draw his left hand out of his pocket till he heard Mr. Sleuth shut the bedroom door upstairs. Then he held up his left hand and looked at it curiously. It was flecked, streaked with pale reddish blood. Taking off his boots, he crept into the room where his wife lay asleep. Stealthily he walked across to the washhand stand and dipped a hand into the water jug. "Whatever are you doing? What on earth are you doing?" came a voice from the bed, and Bunting started guiltily. "I'm just washing my hands." "Indeed, you're doing nothing of the sort. I never heard of such a thing, putting your hand into the water in which I was going to wash my face tomorrow morning." "I'm very sorry, Ellen," he said meekly. "I meant to throw it away. You don't suppose I would have let you wash in dirty water, do you?" She said no more, but as he began undressing himself, Mrs. Bunting lay staring at him in a way that made her husband feel even more uncomfortable than he was already. At last he got into bed. He wanted to break the oppressive silence by telling Ellen about the sovereign the young lady had given him, but that sovereign now seemed to Bunting of no more account than if it had been a farthing he had picked up in the road outside. Once more his wife spoke, and he gave so great a start that it shook the bed. "I suppose that you don't know that you've left the light burning in the hall, wasting our good money," she observed tartly. He got up painfully and opened the door into the passage. It was as she had said. The gas was flaring away, wasting their good money, or rather Mr. Sleuth's good money. Since he had come to be their lodger, they had not had to touch their rent money. Bunting turned out the light and groped his way back to the room, and so to bed. Without speaking again to each other, both husband and wife lay awake till dawn. The next morning Mr. Sleuth's landlord awoke with a start. He felt curiously heavy about the limbs, and tired about the eyes. Drawing his watch from under his pillow, he saw that it was 7 o'clock. Without waking his wife, he got out of bed and pulled the blind a little to one side. It was snowing heavily, and, as is the way when it snows, even in London, everything was strangely, curiously still. After he had dressed, he went out into the passage. As he had at once dreaded and hoped, their newspaper was already lying on the mat. It was probably the sound of its being pushed through the letter-box which had waked him from his unrestful sleep. He picked the paper up and went into the sitting-room then. Shutting the door behind him carefully, he spread the newspaper wide open on the table and bent over it. As Bunting at last looked up and straightened himself, an expression of intense relief shone upon his stolid face. The item of news he had felt certain would be printed in big type on the middle sheet was not there. End of chapter 21. Recording by Leanne Howlett. Chapter 22 of The Lodger. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Leanne Howlett. The Lodger by Marie Belloc Lowndes. Chapter 22. Feeling amazingly light-hearted, almost light-headed, Bunting lit the gas ring to make his wife her morning cup of tea. While he was doing it, he suddenly heard her call out. "Bunting!" she cried weakly. "Bunting!" Quickly he hurried in response to her call. "Yes," he said. "What is it, my dear? I won't be a minute with your tea." And he smiled broadly, rather foolishly. She sat up and looked at him, a dazed expression on her face. "What are you grinning at?" she asked suspiciously. "I've had a wonderful piece of luck," he explained. "But you was so cross last night that I simply didn't dare tell you about it." "Well, tell me now," she said in a low voice. "I had a sovereign given me by the young lady. You see, it was her birthday party, Ellen, and she'd come into a nice bit of money, and she gave each of us waiters a sovereign." Mrs. Bunting made no comment. Instead, she lay back and closed her eyes. "What time do you expect Daisy?" she asked languidly. "You didn't say what time Joe was going to fetch her when we was talking about it yesterday." "Didn't I? Well, I expect they'll be in to dinner." "I wonder how long that old aunt of hers expects us to keep her," said Mrs. Bunting thoughtfully. All the cheer died out of Bunting's round face. He became sullen and angry. It would be a pretty thing if he couldn't have his own daughter for a bit, especially now that they were doing so well. "Daisy'll stay here just as long as she can," he said shortly. "It's too bad of you, Ellen, to talk like that. She helps you all she can, and she brisks us both up ever so much. Besides, 'twould be cruel to take the girl away just now, just as she and that young chap are making friends like. One would suppose that even you would see the justice of that." But Mrs. Bunting made no answer. Bunting went off, back into the sitting-room. The water was boiling now, so he made the tea, and then, as he brought the little tray in, his heart softened. Ellen did look really ill and wizened. He wondered if she had a pain about which she wasn't saying anything. She had never been one to grouse about herself. "The lodger and me came in together last night," he observed genially. "He's certainly a funny kind of gentleman. It wasn't the sort of night one would have chosen to go out for a walk now, was it? And yet he must have been out a long time if what he said was true." "I don't wonder a quiet gentleman like Mr. Sleuth hates the crowded streets," she said slowly. "They gets worse every day, that they do. But go along now, I want to get up." He went back into their sitting-room, and having laid the fire and put a match to it, he sat down comfortably with his newspaper. Deep down in his heart, Bunting looked back to this last night with a feeling of shame and self-rebuke. Whatever had made such horrible thoughts and suspicions as had possessed him suddenly come into his head? And just because of a trifling thing like that blood? No doubt Mr. Sleuth's nose had bled. That was what had happened. Though, come to think of it, he had mentioned brushing up against a dead animal. Perhaps Ellen was right after all. It didn't do for one to be always thinking of dreadful subjects, of murders and such like. It made one go dotty. That's what it did. And just as he was telling himself that, there came to the door a loud knock, the peculiar rat-tat-tat of a telegraph boy. But before he had time to get across the room, let alone to the front door, Ellen had rushed through the room, clad only in a petticoat and shawl. "I'll go," she cried breathlessly. "I'll go, Bunting. Don't you trouble." He stared at her, surprised, and followed her into the hall. She put out a hand, and, hiding herself behind the door, took the telegram from the invisible boy. "You needn't wait," she said. "If there's an answer, we'll send it out ourselves." Then she tore the envelope open. "Oh," she said with a gasp of relief, "it's only from Joe Chandler, to say he can't go over to fetch Daisy this morning. Then you'll have to go." She walked back into their sitting-room. "There," she said. "There it is, Bunting. You just read it." "Am on duty this morning. Cannot fetch Miss Daisy as arranged. Chandler." "I wonder why he's on duty," said Bunting slowly, uncomfortably. "I thought Joe's hours was as regular as clockwork, that nothing could make any difference to them. However, there it is. I suppose it'll do all right if I start about 11 o'clock. It may have left off snowing by then. I don't feel like going out again just now. I'm pretty tired this morning." "You start about 12, said his wife quickly. "That'll give plenty of time." The morning went on quietly, uneventfully. Bunting received a letter from old aunt saying Daisy must come back next Monday, a little under a week from now. Mr. Sleuth slept soundly, or at any rate he made no sign of being awake, and though Mrs. Bunting often stopped to listen while she was doing her room, there came no sounds at all from overhead. Scarcely aware that it was so, both Bunting and his wife felt more cheerful than they had done for a long time. They had quite a pleasant little chat when Mrs. Bunting came and sat down for a bit, before going down to prepare Mr. Sleuth's breakfast. "Daisy will be surprised to see you, not to say disappointed," she observed, and she could not help laughing a little to herself at the thought. And when, at 11, Bunting got up to go, she made him stay on a little longer. "There's no such great hurry as that," she said good-temperedly. "It'll do quite well if you're there by 12:30. I'll get dinner ready myself. Daisy needn't help with that. I expect Margaret has worked her pretty hard." But at last there came the moment when Bunting had to start, and his wife went with him to the front door. It was still snowing, less heavily, but still snowing. There were very few people coming and going, and only just a few cabs and carts dragging cautiously along through the slush. Mrs. Bunting was still in the kitchen when there came a ring and a knock at the door, a now very familiar ring and knock. "Joe thinks Daisy's home again by now," she said, smiling to herself. Before the door was well open, she heard Chandler's voice. "Don't be scared this time, Mrs. Bunting." But though not exactly scared, she did give a gasp of surprise, for there stood Joe, made up to represent a public-house loafer, and he looked the part to perfection, with his hair combed down raggedly over his forehead, his seedy-looking, ill-fitting, dirty clothes, and greenish-black pot hat. "I haven't a minute," he said a little breathlessly, "but I thought I'd just run in to know if Miss Daisy was safe home again. You got my telegram all right? I couldn't send no other kind of message." "She's not back yet. Her father hasn't been gone long after her." Then, struck by a look in his eyes, "Joe, what's the matter?" she asked quickly. There came a thrill of suspense in her voice. Her face grew drawn, while what little color there was in it receded, leaving it very pale. "Well," he said, "well, Mrs. Bunting, I've no business to say anything about it, but I will tell you." He walked in and shut the door of the sitting-room carefully behind him. "There's been another of 'em," he whispered, "but this time no one is to know anything about it, not for the present, I mean," he corrected himself hastily. "The Yard thinks we've got a clue, and a good clue, too, this time."
"But where, and how?" faltered Mrs. Bunting.
"Well, 'twas just a bit of luck being able to keep it dark for the present." He still spoke in that stifled, hoarse whisper. "The poor soul was found dead on a bench on Primrose Hill, and just by chance 'twas one of our fellows saw the body first. He was on his way home, over Hampstead way. He knew where he'd be able to get an ambulance quick, and he made a very clever secret job of it. I expect he'll get promotion for that."
"What about the clue?" asked Mrs. Bunting, with dry lips. "You said there was a clue."
"Well, I don't rightly understand about the clue myself. All I know is it's got something to do with a public house, the Hammer and Tongs, which isn't far off there. They feel sure the Avenger was in the bar just on closing time."
And then Mrs. Bunting sat down. She felt better now. It was natural the police should suspect a public-house loafer.
"Then that's why you wasn't able to go and fetch Daisy, I suppose?"
He nodded. "Mum's the word, Mrs. Bunting. It'll all be in the last editions of the evening newspapers. It can't be kept out. There'd be too much of a row if 'twas."
"Are you going off to that public-house now?" she asked.
"Yes, I am. I've got a awkward job, to try and worm something out of the barmaid."
"Something out of the barmaid?" repeated Mrs. Bunting nervously. "Why, whatever for?"
He came and stood close to her.
"They think 'twas a gentleman," he whispered.
"A gentleman?"
Mrs. Bunting stared at Chandler with a scared expression.
"Whatever makes them think such a silly thing as that?"
"Well, just before closing time a very peculiar-looking gent with a leather bag in his hand went into the bar and asked for a glass of milk. And what do you think he did? Paid for it with a sovereign.
He wouldn't take no change, just made the girl a present of it. That's why the young woman what served him seems quite unwilling to give him away. She won't tell now what he was like. She doesn't know what he's wanted for, and we don't want her to know just yet. That's one reason why nothing's being said public about it. But there, I really must be going now. My time will be up at 3 o'clock. I thought of coming in on the way back and asking you for a cup of tea, Mrs. Bunting. "Do," she said. "Do, Joe. You'll be welcome." But there was no welcome in her tired voice. She let him go alone to the door, and then she went down to her kitchen and began cooking Mr. Sleuth's breakfast. The lodger would be sure to ring soon, and then any minute Bunting and Daisy might be home, and they'd want something, too. Margaret always had breakfast even when the family were away, unnaturally early. As she bustled about, Mrs. Bunting tried to empty her mind of all thought. But it is very difficult to do that when one is in a state of torturing uncertainty. She had not dared to ask Chandler what they supposed that man who had gone into the public house was really like. It was fortunate, indeed, that the lodger and that inquisitive young chap had never met face to face. At last Mr. Sleuth's bell rang, a quiet little tinkle, but when she went up with his breakfast the lodger was not in his sitting-room. Supposing him to be still in his bedroom, Mrs. Bunting put the cloth on the table, and then she heard the sound of his footsteps coming down the stairs, and her quick ears detected the slight whirring sound which showed that the gas stove was alight. Mr. Sleuth had already lit the stove. That meant that he would carry out some elaborate experiment this afternoon. "Still snowing?" he said doubtfully. "How very, very quiet and still London is when under snow, Mrs. Bunting. I have never known it quite as quiet as this morning. Not a sound, outside or in. A very pleasant change from the shouting which sometimes goes on in the Marylebone Road." "Yes," she said dully. "It's awful quiet today, too quiet to my thinking. 'Tain't natural-like." The outside gate swung to, making a noisy clatter in the still air. "Is that someone coming in here?" asked Mr. Sleuth, drawing a quick, hissing breath. "Perhaps you will oblige me by going to the window and telling me who it is, Mrs. Bunting?" And his landlady obeyed him. "It's only Bunting, sir, Bunting and his daughter." "Oh, is that all?" Mr. Sleuth hurried after her, and she shrank back a little. She had never been quite so near to the lodger before, save on that first day when she had been showing him her rooms. Side by side they stood, looking out of the window, and as if aware that someone was standing there, Daisy turned her bright face up towards the window and smiled at her stepmother and at the lodger, whose face she could only dimly discern. "A very sweet-looking young girl," said Mr. Sleuth thoughtfully, and then he quoted a little bit of poetry, and this took Mrs. Bunting very much aback. "Wordsworth," he murmured dreamily, "a poet too little read nowadays, Mrs. Bunting, but one with a beautiful feeling for nature, for youth, for innocence."
"Indeed, sir?" Mrs. Bunting stepped back a little. "Your breakfast will be getting cold, sir, if you don't have it now."
He went back to the table obediently and sat down as a child rebuked might have done. And then his landlady left him. "Well," said Bunting cheerily, "everything went off quite all right, and Daisy's a lucky girl, that she is. Her Aunt Margaret gave her 5 shillings." But Daisy did not look as pleased as her father thought she ought to do.
"I hope nothing's happened to Mr. Chandler," she said a little disconsolately. "The very last words he said to me last night was that he'd be there at 10 o'clock. I got quite fidgety as the time went on, and he didn't come."
"He's been here," said Mrs. Bunting slowly.
"Been here?" cried her husband. "Then why on earth didn't he go and fetch Daisy if he'd time to come here?"
"He was on the way to his job," his wife answered. "You run along, child, downstairs. Now that you are here you can make yourself useful."
And Daisy reluctantly obeyed. She wondered what it was her stepmother didn't want her to hear.
"I've something to tell you, Bunting."
"Yes?" He looked across uneasily. "Yes, Ellen?"
"There's been another of those murders, but the police don't want anyone to know about it, not yet. That's why Joe couldn't go over and fetch Daisy. They're all on duty again."
Bunting put out his hand and clutched hold of the edge of the mantelpiece. He had gone very red, but his wife was far too much concerned with her own feelings and sensations to notice it. There was a long silence between them. Then he spoke, making a great effort to appear unconcerned. "And where did it happen?" he asked. "Close to the other one?" She hesitated. Then, "I don't know. He didn't say. But hush," she added quickly. "Here's Daisy. Don't let's talk of that horror in front of her like. Besides, I promised Chandler I'd be mum." And he acquiesced. "You can be laying the cloth, child, while I go up and clear away the lodger's breakfast." Without waiting for an answer, she hurried upstairs. Mr. Sleuth had left the greater part of the nice lemon sole untouched. "I don't feel well today," he said fretfully. "And Mrs. Bunting, I should be much obliged if your husband would lend me that paper I saw in his hand. I do not often care to look at the public prints, but I should like to do so now." She flew downstairs. "Bunting," she said a little breathlessly, "the lodger would like you just to lend him the Sun." Bunting handed it over to her. "I've read it through," he observed. "You can tell him that I don't want it back again." On her way up, she glanced down at the pink sheet. Occupying a third of the space was an irregular drawing, and under it was written, in rather large characters, "We are glad to be able to present our readers with an authentic reproduction of the footprint of the half-worn rubber sole which was almost certainly worn by the Avenger when he committed his double murder 10 days ago." She went into the sitting room. To her relief, it was empty. "Kindly put the paper down on the table," came Mr. Sleuth's muffled voice from the upper landing. She did so. "Yes, sir, and Bunting don't want the paper back again, sir. He says he's read it." And then she hurried out of the room. End of chapter 22. Recording by Leanne Howlett. Chapter 23 of The Lodger. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Leanne Howlett. The Lodger by Marie Belloc Lowndes. Chapter 23. All afternoon it went on snowing, and the three of them sat there, listening and waiting. Bunting and his wife hardly knew for what. Daisy for the knock which would herald Joe Chandler. And about four there came the now familiar sound. Mrs. Bunting hurried out into the passage, and as she opened the front door she whispered, "We haven't said anything to Daisy yet. Young girls can't keep secrets." Chandler nodded comprehendingly. He now looked the low character he had assumed to the life, for he was blue with cold, disheartened, and tired out. Daisy gave a little cry of shocked surprise, of amusement, of welcome, when she saw how cleverly he was disguised. "I never!" she exclaimed. "What a difference it do make, to be sure! Why, you looks quite horrid, Mr. Chandler!" And somehow that little speech of hers amused her father so much that he quite cheered up. Bunting had been very dull and quiet all that afternoon. "It won't take me 10 minutes to make myself respectable again," said the young man rather ruefully. His host and hostess, looking at him eagerly, furtively, both came to the conclusion that he had been unsuccessful, that he had failed, that is, in getting any information worth having. And though, in a sense, they all had a pleasant tea together, there was an air of constraint, even of discomfort, over the little party. Bunting felt it hard that he couldn't ask the questions that were trembling on his lips. He would have felt it hard any time during the last month to refrain from knowing anything Joe could tell him, but now it seemed almost intolerable to be in this queer kind of half-suspense. There was one important fact he longed to know, and at last came his opportunity of doing so, for Joe Chandler rose to leave, and this time it was Bunting who followed him out into the hall. "Where did it happen?" he whispered. "Just tell me that, Joe." "Primrose Hill," said the other briefly. "You'll know all about it in a minute or two, for it'll be all in the last editions of the evening papers.
That's what's been arranged.
No arrest, I suppose?
Chandler shook his head despondently. No, he said. I'm inclined to think the Yard was on a wrong tack altogether this time. But one can only do one's best. I don't know if Mrs. Bunting told you I'd got to question a barmaid about a man who was in her place just before closing time. Well, she said all she knew, and it's as clear as daylight to me that the eccentric old gent she talks about was only a harmless loony. He gave her a sovereign just because she told him she was a teetotaler. He laughed ruefully. Even Bunting was diverted at the notion.
"Well, that's a queer thing for a barmaid to be," he exclaimed. "She's niece to the people what keeps the public," explained Chandler, and then he went out of the front door with a cheerful, "So long!"
When Bunting went back into the sitting-room, Daisy had disappeared. She had gone downstairs with the tray.
"Where's my girl?" he said irritably.
"She's just taken the tray downstairs." He went out to the top of the kitchen stairs and called out sharply, "Daisy! Daisy, child! Are you down there?"
"Yes, father," came her eager, happy voice. "Better come up out of that cold kitchen."
He turned and came back to his wife.
"Ellen, is the lodger in? I haven't heard him moving about. Now mind what I says, please. I don't want Daisy to be mixed up with him."
"Mr. Sleuth don't seem very well today," answered Mrs. Bunting quietly. "'Tain't likely I should let Daisy have anything to do with him. Why, she's never even seen him. 'Tain't likely I should allow her to begin waiting on him now." But though she was surprised and a little irritated by the tone in which Bunting had spoken, no glimmer of the truth illumined her mind. So accustomed had she become to bearing alone the burden of her awful secret that it would have required far more than a cross word or two, far more than the fact that Bunting looked ill and tired, for her to have come to suspect that her secret was now shared by another, and that other her husband. Again and again the poor soul had agonized and trembled at the thought of her house being invaded by the police, but that was only because she had always credited the police with supernatural powers of detection. That they should come to know the awful fact she kept hidden in her breast would have seemed to her, on the whole, a natural thing, but that Bunting should even dimly suspect it appeared beyond the range of possibility. And yet even Daisy noticed a change in her father. He sat cowering over the fire, saying nothing, doing nothing.
"Why, father, ain't you well?" the girl asked more than once. And looking up he would answer, "Yes, I'm well enough, my girl, but I feels cold. It's awful cold. I never did feel anything like the cold we've got just now."
At 8 the now familiar shouts and cries began again outside. "The Avenger again! Another horrible crime! Extra special edition!" Such were the shouts, the exultant yells, hurled through the clear, cold air. They fell, like bombs, into the quiet room. Both Bunting and his wife remained silent, but Daisy's cheeks grew pink with excitement, and her eyes sparkled.
"Hark, father! Hark, Ellen! Do you hear that?" she exclaimed childishly, and even clapped her hands. "I do wish Mr. Chandler had been here. He would have been startled."
"Don't, Daisy," and Bunting frowned. Then, getting up, he stretched himself. "It's fair getting on my mind," he said, "these terrible things happening. I'd like to get right away from London, just as far as I could. That I would."
"Up to John O'Groats," said Daisy, laughing, and then, "Why, father, ain't you going out to get a paper?"
"Yes, I suppose I must." Slowly he went out of the room, and lingering a moment in the hall, he put on his greatcoat and hat. Then he opened the front door and walked down the flagged path. Opening the iron gate, he stepped out on the pavement, then crossed the road to where the newspaper boys now stood. The boy nearest to him only had the Sun, a late edition of the paper he had already read. It annoyed Bunting to give a penny for a halfpenny rag of which he already knew the main contents, but there was nothing else to do. Standing under a lamp-post, he opened out the newspaper. It was bitingly cold. That, perhaps, was why his hand shook as he looked down at the big headlines. for Bunting had been very unfair to the enterprise of the editor of his favorite evening paper. This special edition was full of new matter concerning The Avenger. First, in huge type, right across the page, was the brief statement that The Avenger had now committed his ninth crime, and that he had chosen quite a new locality, namely, the lonely stretch of rising ground known to Londoners as Primrose Hill. "The police," so Bunting read, "are very reserved as to the circumstances which led to the finding of the body of The Avenger's latest victim. But we have reason to believe that they possess several really important clues, and that one of them is concerned with the half-worn rubber sole of which we are the first to reproduce an outline today. See over page." And Bunting, turning the sheet round about, saw the irregular outline he had already seen in the early edition of The Sun, that purporting to be a facsimile of the imprint left by The Avenger's rubber sole. He stared down at the rough outline which took up so much of the space which should have been devoted to reading matter, with a queer sinking feeling of terrified alarm. Again and again criminals had been tracked by the marks their boots or shoes had made at or near the scenes of their misdoings. Practically the only job Bunting did in his own house of a menial kind was the cleaning of the boots and shoes. He had already visualized early this very afternoon the little row with which he dealt each morning. First came his wife's strong, serviceable boots, then his own two pairs, a good deal patched and mended, and next to his own Mr. Sleuth's strong, hardly worn, and expensive button boots. Of late, a dear little coquettish, high-heeled pair of outdoor shoes with thin, paper-like soles, bought by Daisy for her trip to London, had ended the row. The girl had worn these thin shoes persistently, in defiance of Ellen's reproof and advice, and he, Bunting, had only once had to clean her more sensible country pair, and that only because the others had become wet though the day he and she had accompanied young Chandler to Scotland Yard. Slowly he returned across the road. Somehow the thought of going in again, of hearing his wife's sarcastic comments, of parrying Daisy's eager questions, had become intolerable. So he walked slowly, trying to put off the evil moment when he would have to tell them what was in his paper. The lamp under which he had stood reading was not exactly opposite the house. It was rather to the right of it. And when, having crossed over the roadway, he walked along the pavement towards his own gate, he heard odd shuffling sounds coming from the inner side of the low wall which shut off his little courtyard from the pavement. Now, under ordinary circumstances, Bunting would have rushed forward to drive out whoever was there. He and his wife had often had trouble, before the cold weather began, with vagrants seeking shelter there. But tonight he stayed outside, listening intently, sick with suspense and fear. Was it possible that their place was being watched, already? He thought it was only too likely. Bunting, like Mrs. Bunting, credited the police with almost supernatural powers, especially since he had paid that visit to Scotland Yard. But to Bunting's amazement, and yes, relief, it was his lodger who suddenly loomed up in the dim light. Mr. Sleuth must have been stooping down, for his tall, lank form had been quite concealed till he stepped forward from behind the low wall onto the flagged path leading to the front door. The lodger was carrying a brown paper parcel, and as he walked along, the new boots he was wearing creaked, and the tap-tap of hard, nail-studded heels rang out on the flat stones of the narrow path. Bunting, still standing outside the gate, suddenly knew what it was his lodger had been doing on the other side of the low wall. Mr. Sleuth had evidently been out to buy himself another pair of new boots, and then he had gone inside the gate and had put them on, placing his old footgear in the paper in which the new pair had been wrapped. The ex-butler waited quite a long time, not only until Mr. Sleuth had let himself into the house, but till the lodger had had time to get well away upstairs. Then he also walked up the flagged pathway and put his latch-key in the door. He lingered as long over the job of hanging his hat and coat up in the hall as he dared, in fact, till his wife called out to him. Then he went in, and throwing the paper down on the table, he said sullenly, "There it is. You can see it all for yourself. Not that there's very much to see," and groped his way to the fire. His wife looked at him in sharp alarm. "Whatever have you done to yourself?" she exclaimed. "You're ill. That's what it is, Bunting. You got a chill last night." "I told you I'd got a chill," he muttered. "'Twasn't last night, though. "'Twas going out this morning, coming back in the bus. "'Margaret keeps that housekeeper's room of hers like a hothouse. "'That's what she does. "'Twas going out from there into the biting wind. "'That's what did for me. "'It must be awful to stand about in such weather. "'Tis a wonder to me how that young fellow, Joe Chandler, can stand the life, "'being out in all weathers like he is.' "'Bunting spoke at random, his one anxiety being to get away from what was in the paper, "'which now lay neglected on the table. "'Those that keep out of doors all day never do come to no harm,' said his wife testily. "'But if you felt so bad, whatever was you out so long for, Bunting? "'I thought you'd gone away somewhere. "'Do you mean you only went to get the paper?' "'I just stopped for a second to look at it under the lamp,' he muttered apologetically. "'That was a silly thing to do.' "'Perhaps it was,' he admitted meekly. Daisy had taken up the paper. "'Well, they don't say much,' she said disappointedly. "'Hardly anything at all. "'But perhaps Mr. Chandler'll be in soon again. "'If so, he'll tell us more about it.' "'A young girl like you oughtn't to want to know anything about murders,' said her stepmother severely. "'Joe won't think any the better of you for your inquisitiveness about such things. "'If I was you, Daisy, I shouldn't say nothing about it if he does come in, "'which I fair tell you I hope he won't. "'I've seen enough of that young chap today.'
"'He didn't come in for long, not today,' said Daisy, her lip trembling.
"'I can tell you one thing that'll surprise you, my dear.' Mrs. Bunting looked significantly at her stepdaughter. She also wanted to get away from that dread news, which yet was no news.
"'Yes,' said Daisy rather defiantly. "'What is it, Ellen?'
"'Maybe you'll be surprised to hear that Joe did come in this morning. He knew all about that affair then, but he particular asked that you shouldn't be told anything about it.'
"'Never!' cried Daisy, much mortified.
"'Yes,' went on her stepmother ruthlessly. "'You just ask your father over there if it isn't true.'
"'Tain't a healthy thing to speak over much about such happenings,' said Bunting heavily.
"'If I was Joe,' went on Mrs. Bunting, quickly pursuing her advantage, "'I shouldn't want to talk about such horrid things when I comes in to have a quiet chat with friends. But the minute he comes in that poor young chap is set upon, mostly, I admit, by your father.' She looked at her husband severely. "'But you does your share, too, Daisy. You ask him this, you ask him that. He's fair puzzled sometimes. It don't do to be so inquisitive.' And perhaps because of this little sermon on Mrs. Bunting's part, when young Chandler did come in again that evening, very little was said of the new Avenger murder. Bunting made no reference to it at all, and though Daisy said a word, it was but a word. And Joe Chandler thought he had never spent a pleasanter evening in his life, for it was he and Daisy who talked all the time, their elders remaining for the most part silent. Daisy told of all that she had done with Aunt Margaret. She described the long, dull hours and the queer jobs her aunt set her to do, the washing up of all the fine drawing-room china in a big basin lined with flannel, and how terrified she, Daisy, had been lest there should come even one teeny little chip to any of it. Then she went on to relate some of the funny things Aunt Margaret had told her about the family. There came a really comic tale, which hugely interested and delighted Chandler. This was of how Aunt Margaret's lady had been taken in by an impostor who had come up, just as she was stepping out of her carriage, and pretended to have a fit on the doorstep. Aunt Margaret's lady, being a soft one, had insisted on the man coming into the hall, where he had been given all kinds of restoratives. When the man had at last gone off, it was found that he had wolfed young master's best walking-stick, one with a fine tortoise-shell top to it. Thus had Aunt Margaret proved to her lady that the man had been shamming, and her lady had been very angry, near had a fit herself. "'There's a lot of that about,' said Chandler, laughing. "'Incorrigible rogues and vagabonds, that's what those sort of people are.' And then he, in his turn, told an elaborate tale of an exceptionally clever swindler who he himself had brought to book. He was very proud of that job. It had formed a white stone in his career as a detective, and even Mrs. Bunting was quite interested to hear about it. Chandler was still sitting there when Mr. Sleuth's bell rang. For a while no one stirred. Then Bunting looked questioningly at his wife. "'Did you hear that?' he said. "'I think, Ellen, that was the lodger's bell.' She got up, without alacrity, and went upstairs.
"I rang," said Mr. Sleuth weakly, "to tell you I don't require any supper tonight, Mrs. Bunting. Only a glass of milk with a lump of sugar in it. That is all I require, nothing more. I feel very, very far from well." And he had a hunted, plaintive expression on his face. "And then I thought your husband would like his paper back again, Mrs. Bunting." Mrs. Bunting, looking at him fixedly, with a sad intensity of gaze of which she was quite unconscious, answered, "Oh, no, sir. Bunting don't require that paper now. He read it all through." Something impelled her to add ruthlessly, "He's got another paper by now, sir. You may have heard them come shouting outside. Would you like me to bring you up that other paper, sir?" And Mr. Sleuth shook his head. "No," he said querulously. "I much regret now having asked for the one paper I did read, for it disturbed me, Mrs. Bunting. There was nothing of any value in it. There never is in any public print. I gave up reading newspapers years ago, and I much regret that I broke, though, my rule today." And as if to indicate to her that he did not wish for any more conversation, the lodger then did what he had never done before in his landlady's presence. He went over to the fireplace and deliberately turned his back on her. She went down and brought up the glass of milk and the lump of sugar he had asked for. Now he was in his usual place, sitting at the table, studying the book. When Mrs. Bunting went back to the others, they were chatting merrily. She did not notice that the merriment was confined to the two young people.
"Well," said Daisy pertly, "how about the lodger, Ellen? Is he all right?"
"Yes," she said stiffly, "of course he is."
"He must feel pretty dull sitting up there all by himself. Awful lonely, like I call it," said the girl.
But her stepmother remained silent.
"Whatever does he do with himself all day?" persisted Daisy.
"Just now he's reading the Bible," Mrs. Bunting answered, shortly and dryly.
"Well, I never. That's a funny thing for a gentleman to do."
And Joe, alone of her three listeners, laughed, a long, hearty peal of amusement.
"There's nothing to laugh at," said Mrs. Bunting sharply. "I should feel ashamed of being caught laughing at anything connected with the Bible." And poor Joe became suddenly quite serious. This was the first time that Mrs. Bunting had ever spoken really nastily to him, and he answered very humbly, "I beg pardon. I know I oughtn't to have laughed at anything to do with the Bible. But you see, Miss Daisy said it so funny-like, and by all accounts your lodger must be a queer card, Mrs. Bunting."
"He's no queerer than many people I could mention," she said quickly, and with these enigmatic words she got up and left the room.
End of chapter 23. Recording by Leanne Howlett. Chapter 24 of The Lodger. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Leanne Howlett. The Lodger by Marie Belloc Lowndes. Chapter 24. Each hour of the days that followed held for Bunting its full meed of aching fear and suspense. The unhappy man was ever debating within himself what course he should pursue, and, according to his mood and to the state of his mind at any particular moment, he would waver between various widely differing lines of action. He told himself again and again, and with fretful unease, that the most awful thing about it all was that he wasn't sure. If only he could have been sure, he might have made up his mind exactly what it was he ought to do. But when telling himself this, he was deceiving himself, and he was vaguely conscious of the fact, for, from Bunting's point of view, almost any alternative would have been preferable to that which to some, nay, perhaps to most, householders would have seemed the only thing to do, namely, to go to the police. But Londoners of Bunting's class have an uneasy fear of the law. To his mind it would be ruin for him and for his Ellen to be mixed up publicly in such a terrible affair. No one concerned in the business would give them and their future a thought, but it would track them to their dying day, and above all, it would make it quite impossible for them ever to get again into a good joint situation. It was that for which Bunting, in his secret soul, now longed with all his heart.
No, some other way than going to the police must be found, and he racked his slow brain to find it. The worst of it was that every hour that went by made his future course more difficult and more delicate, and increased the awful weight on his conscience. If only he really knew, if only he could feel quite sure, and then he would tell himself that, after all, he had very little to go upon, only suspicion, suspicion and a secret horrible certainty that his suspicion was justified. And so at last Bunting began to long for a solution which he knew to be indefensible from every point of view. He began to hope, that is, in the depths of his heart, that the lodger would again go out one evening on his horrible business and be caught, red-handed. But far from going out on any business, horrible or other, Mr. Sleuth now never went out at all. He kept upstairs and often spent quite a considerable part of his day in bed. He still felt, so he assured Mrs. Bunting, very far from well. He had never thrown off the chill he had caught on that bitter night he and his landlord had met on their several ways home. Joe Chandler, too, had become a terrible complication to Daisy's father. The detective spent every waking hour that he was not on duty with the Buntings, and Bunting, who at one time had liked him so well and so cordially, now became mortally afraid of him. But though the young man talked of little else than the Avenger, and though on one evening he described at immense length the eccentric-looking gent who had given the barmaid a sovereign, picturing Mr. Sleuth with such awful accuracy that both Bunting and Mrs. Bunting secretly and separately turned sick when they listened to him, he never showed the slightest interest in their lodger. At last there came a morning when Bunting and Chandler held a strange conversation about the Avenger. The young fellow had come in earlier than usual, and just as he arrived, Mrs. Bunting and Daisy were starting out to do some shopping. The girl would fain have stopped behind, but her stepmother had given her a very peculiar, disagreeable look, daring her, so to speak, to be so forward, and Daisy had gone on with a flushed, angry look on her pretty face. And then, as young Chandler stepped through into the sitting-room, it suddenly struck Bunting that the young man looked unlike himself. Indeed, to the ex-butler's apprehension, there was something almost threatening in Chandler's attitude. "I want a word with you, Mr. Bunting," he began abruptly, falteringly, "and I'm glad to have the chance now that Mrs. Bunting and Miss Daisy are out." Bunting braced himself to hear the awful words, the accusation of having sheltered a murderer, the monster whom all the world was seeking under his roof. And then he remembered a phrase, a horrible legal phrase, "accessory after the fact." Yes, he had been that. There wasn't any doubt about it. "Yes," he said. "What is it, Joe?" And then the unfortunate man sat down in his chair. "Yes," he said again uncertainly, for young Chandler had now advanced to the table. He was looking at Bunting fixedly, the other thought threateningly. "Well, out with it, Joe. Don't keep me in suspense." And then a slight smile broke over the young man's face. "I don't think what I've got to say can take you by surprise, Mr. Bunting." And Bunting wagged his head in a way that might mean anything, yes or no, as the case might be. The two men looked at one another for what seemed a very, very long time to the elder of them. And then, making a great effort, Joe Chandler brought out the words. "Well, I suppose you know what it is I want to talk about. I'm sure Mrs. Bunting would, from a look or two she's lately cast on me. It's your daughter. It's Miss Daisy." And then Bunting gave a kind of cry, twixt a sob and a laugh. "My girl," he cried. "Good Lord, Joe, is that all you wants to talk about? Why, you fair frightened me, that you did." And indeed the relief was so great that the room swam round as he stared across it at his daughter's lover, that lover who was also the embodiment of that now awful thing to him, the law. He smiled, rather foolishly, at his visitor, and Chandler felt a sharp wave of irritation, of impatience sweep over his good-natured soul. Daisy's father was an old stupid. That's what he was. And then Bunting grew serious. The room ceased to go round. "As far as I'm concerned," he said, with a good deal of solemnity, even a little dignity, "you have my blessing, Joe. You're a very likely young chap, and I had a true respect for your father." "Yes," said Chandler, "that's very kind of you, Mr. Bunting. But how about her? Her herself?" Bunting stared at him. It pleased him to think that Daisy hadn't given herself away, as Ellen was always hinting the girl was doing. "I can't answer for Daisy," he said heavily. "You'll have to ask her yourself. That's not a job any other man can do for you, my lad."
"I never gets a chance. I never sees her, not by our two selves," said Chandler with some heat. "You don't seem to understand, Mr. Bunting, that I never do see Miss Daisy alone," he repeated. "I hear now that she's going away Monday, and I've only once had the chance of a walk with her. Mrs. Bunting's very particular, not to say pernickety in her ideas, Mr. Bunting." "That's a fault on the right side, that is, with a young girl," said Bunting thoughtfully. And Chandler nodded. He quite agreed that as regarded other young chaps, Mrs. Bunting could not be too particular. "She's been brought up like a lady, my Daisy has," went on Bunting with some pride. "That old aunt of hers hardly lets her out of her sight."
"I was coming to the old aunt," said Chandler heavily. "Mrs. Bunting, she talks as if your daughter was going to stay with that old woman the whole of her natural life. Now is that right? That's what I wants to ask you, Mr. Bunting. Is that right?"
"I'll say a word to Ellen, don't you fear," said Bunting abstractedly. His mind had wandered off, away from Daisy and this nice young chap, to his now constant, anxious preoccupation. "You come along tomorrow," he said, "and I'll see you gets your walk with Daisy. It's only right you and she should have a chance of seeing one another without old folk being by, else how's the girl to tell whether she likes you or not? For the matter of that, you hardly knows her, Joe." He looked at the young man consideringly. Chandler shook his head impatiently. "I knows her quite as well as I wants to know her," he said. "I made up my mind the very first time I seed her, Mr. Bunting."
"No, did you really?" said Bunting. "Well, come to think of it, I did so with her mother. Aye, and years after with Ellen, too. But I hope you'll never want no second, Chandler."
"God forbid," said the young man under his breath. And then he asked, rather longingly, "Do you think they'll be out long now, Mr. Bunting?" And Bunting woke up to a due sense of hospitality. Sit down, do," he said hastily. "I don't believe they'll be very long. They've only got a little bit of shopping to do." And then, in a changed, in a ringing, nervous tone, he asked, "And how about your job, Joe? Nothing new, I take it? I suppose you're all just waiting for the next time?"
"Aye, that's about the figure of it." Chandler's voice had also changed. It was now somber, menacing. "We're fair tired of it, beginning to wonder when it'll end, that we are."
"Do you ever try and make to yourself a picture of what the master's like?" asked Bunting. Somehow he felt he must ask that.
"Yes," said Joe slowly, "I've a sort of notion. A savage, fierce-looking devil, the chap must be. It's that description that was circulated put us wrong. I don't believe it was the man that knocked up against that woman in the fog. No, not one bit I don't. But I wavers. I can't quite make up my mind. Sometimes I think it's a sailor. The foreigner they talks about, that goes away for 8 or 9 days in between, to Holland, maybe, or to France. Then again, I says to myself that it's a butcher, a man from the Central Market. Whoever it is, it's someone used to killing. That's flat."
"Then it don't seem to you possible." Bunting got up and walked over to the window. "You don't take any stock, I suppose, in that idea some of the papers put out, that the man is—" Then he hesitated and brought out with a gasp, "a gentleman." Chandler looked at him, surprised.
"No," he said deliberately. "I've made up my mind that's quite a wrong tack, though I knows that some of our fellows, big pots, too, are quite sure that the fellow what gave the girl the sovereign is the man we're looking for. You see, Mr. Bunting, if that's the fact— Well, it stands to reason the fellow's an escaped lunatic, and if he's an escaped lunatic, he's got a keeper, and they'd be raising a hue and cry after him, now wouldn't they?"
"You don't think," went on Bunting, lowering his voice, "that he could be just staying somewhere, lodging-like?"
"Do you mean that the Avenger may be a toff, staying in some West End hotel, Mr. Bunting? Well, things almost as funny as that'd be have come to pass." He smiled as if the notion was a funny one.
"Yes, something of that sort," muttered Bunting. "Well, if your idea's correct, Mr. Bunting—"
"I never said 'twas my idea," said Bunting, all in a hurry.
"Well, if that idea's correct, then, 'twill make our task more difficult than ever. Why, 'twould be looking for a needle in a field of hay, Mr. Bunting. But there,
"I don't think it's anything quite so unlikely as that. Not myself, I don't." He hesitated. "There's some of us," he lowered his voice, "that hopes he'll betake himself off, the Avenger, I mean, to another big city, to Manchester or to Edinburgh. There'd be plenty of work for him to do there." And Chandler chuckled at his own grim joke. And then, to both men's secret relief, for Bunting was now mortally afraid of this discussion concerning the Avenger and his doings, they heard Mrs. Bunting's key in the lock. Daisy blushed rosy red with pleasure when she saw that young Chandler was still there. She had feared that when they got home he would be gone, the more so that Ellen, just as if she was doing it on purpose, had lingered aggravatingly long over each small purchase. "Here's Joe come to ask if he can take Daisy out for a walk," blurted out Bunting. "My mother says as how she'd like you to come to tea over at Richmond," said Chandler awkwardly. "I just come in to see whether we could fix it up, Miss Daisy," and Daisy looked imploringly at her stepmother. "Do you mean now, this minute?" asked Mrs. Bunting tartly. "No, of course not," Bunting broke in hastily. "How you do go on, Ellen?" "What day did your mother mention would be convenient to her?" asked Mrs. Bunting, looking at the young man satirically. Chandler hesitated. His mother had not mentioned any special day. In fact, his mother had shown a surprising lack of anxiety to see Daisy at all. But he had talked her round. "How about Saturday?" suggested Bunting. "That's Daisy's birthday. 'Twould be a birthday treat for her to go to Richmond, and she's going back to old aunt on Monday." "I can't go Saturday," said Chandler disconsolately. "I'm on duty Saturday." "Well, then, let it be Sunday," said Bunting firmly, and his wife looked at him surprised. He seldom asserted himself so much in her presence. "What do you say, Miss Daisy?" said Chandler. "Sunday would be very nice," said Daisy demurely. And then, as the young man took up his hat, and as her stepmother did not stir, Daisy ventured to go out into the hall with him for a minute. Chandler shut the door behind them, and so was spared the hearing of Mrs. Bunting's whispered remark. "When I was a young woman, folk didn't gallivant about on Sunday. Those who was courting used to go to church together, decent-like." End of chapter 24. Recording by Leanne Howlett. Chapter 25 of The Lodger. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Leanne Howlett. The Lodger by Marie Belloc Lowndes. Chapter 25. Daisy's 18th birthday dawned uneventfully. Her father gave her what he had always promised she should have on her 18th birthday, a watch. It was a pretty little silver watch, which Bunting had bought second-hand on the last day he had been happy. It seemed a long, long time ago now. Mrs. Bunting thought a silver watch a very extravagant present, but she was far too wretched, far too absorbed in her own thoughts, to trouble much about it. Besides, in such matters, she had generally had the good sense not to interfere between her husband and his child. In the middle of the birthday morning, Bunting went out to buy himself some more tobacco. He had never smoked so much as in the last 4 days, excepting, perhaps, the week that had followed on his leaving service. Smoking a pipe had then held all the exquisite pleasure which we are told attaches itself to the eating of forbidden fruit. His tobacco had now become his only relaxation. It acted on his nerves as an opiate, soothing his fears and helping him to think. But he had been overdoing it, and it was that which now made him feel so jumpy, so he assured himself, when he found himself starting at any casual sound outside, or even when his wife spoke to him suddenly. Just now Ellen and Daisy were down in the kitchen, and Bunting didn't quite like the sensation of knowing that there was only one pair of stairs between Mr. Sleuth and himself. So he quietly slipped out of the house without telling Ellen that he was going out. In the last 4 days Bunting had avoided his usual haunts. Above all, he had avoided even passing the time of day to his acquaintances and neighbors. He feared, with a great fear, that they would talk to him of a subject which, because it filled his mind to the exclusion of all else, might make him betray the knowledge—no, not knowledge, rather the suspicion that dwelt within him. But today the unfortunate man had a curious, instinctive longing for human companionship. companionship, that is, other than that of his wife and of his daughter. This longing for a change of company finally led him into a small, populous thoroughfare hard by the Edgware Road. There were more people there than usual just now, for the housewives of the neighborhood were doing their Saturday marketing for Sunday. The ex-butler turned into a small, old-fashioned shop where he generally bought his tobacco. Bunting passed the time of day with the tobacconist, and the two fell into desultory talk, but to his customer's relief and surprise, the man made no allusion to the subject of which all the neighborhood must still be talking. And then, quite suddenly, while still standing by the counter, and before he had paid for the packet of tobacco he held in his hand, Bunting, through the open door, saw with horrified surprise that Ellen, his wife, was standing alone outside a greengrocer's shop just opposite. Muttering a word of apology, he rushed out of the shop and across the road. "Ellen," he gasped hoarsely, "you've never gone and left my little girl alone in the house with the lodger?" Mrs. Bunting's face went yellow with fear. "I thought you was indoors," she cried. "You was indoors. Whatever made you come out for, without first making sure I'd stay in?" Bunting made no answer, but as they stared at each other in exasperated silence, each now knew that the other knew. They turned and scurried down the crowded street. "Don't run," he said suddenly. "We shall get there just as quickly if we walk fast. People are noticing you, Ellen. Don't run." He spoke breathlessly, but it was breathlessness induced by fear and by excitement, not by the quick pace at which they were walking. At last they reached their own gate, and Bunting pushed past in front of his wife. After all, Daisy was his child. Ellen couldn't know how he was feeling. He seemed to take the path in one leap, then fumbled for a moment with his latch key. Opening wide the door, "Daisy," he called out in a wailing voice, "Daisy, my dear, where are you?"
"Here I am, Father. What is it?"
"She's all right." Bunting turned a gray face to his wife. "She's all right, Ellen." He waited a moment, leaning against the wall of the passage. "It did give me a turn," he said, and then warningly, "Don't frighten the girl, Ellen." Daisy was standing before the fire in their sitting room, admiring herself in the glass.
"Oh, Father," she exclaimed, without turning round, "I've seen the lodger. He's quite a nice gentleman, though to be sure he does look a cure. He rang his bell, but I didn't like to go up, and so he came down to ask Ellen for something. We had quite a nice little chat, that we had. I told him it was my birthday, and he asked me and Ellen to go to Madame Tussaud's with him this afternoon." She laughed, a little self-consciously. "Of course, I could see he was centric, and then at first he spoke so funnily. 'And who be you?' he says, threatening-like. And I says to him, 'I'm Mr. Bunting's daughter, sir.' 'Then you're a very fortunate girl,' that's what he says, Ellen, 'to have such a nice stepmother as you've got. That's why,' he says, 'you look such a good, innocent girl.' And then he quoted a bit of the prayer book. 'Keep innocency,' he says, wagging his head at me. Lord, it made me feel as if I was with old aunt again." "I won't have you going out with the lodger. That's flat." Bunting spoke in a muffled, angry tone. He was wiping his forehead with one hand, while with the other he mechanically squeezed the little packet of tobacco, for which, as he now remembered, he had forgotten to pay. Daisy pouted. "Oh, Father, I think you might let me have a treat on my birthday. I told him that Saturday wasn't a very good day, at least so I'd heard, for Madame Tussaud's. Then he said we could go early, while the fine folk are still having their dinners." She turned to her stepmother, then giggled happily. "He particularly said you was to come, too. The lodger has a wonderful fancy for you, Ellen. If I was Father, I'd feel quite jealous."
Her last words were cut across by a tap-tap on the door. Bunting and his wife looked at each other apprehensively. Was it possible that, in their agitation, they had left the front door open, and that someone, some merciless myrmidon of the law, had crept in behind them? Both felt a curious thrill of satisfaction when they saw that it was only Mr. Sleuth. Mr. Sleuth dressed for going out. The tall hat he had worn when he had first come to them was in his hand, but he was wearing a coat instead of his Inverness cape. "I heard you come in," he addressed Mrs. Bunting in his high, whistling, hesitating voice, "and so I've come down to ask you if you and Miss Bunting will come to Madame Tussaud's now. I have never seen those famous waxworks, though I have heard of the place all my life." As Bunting forced himself to look fixedly at his lodger, a sudden doubt bringing with it a sense of immeasurable relief came to Mr. Sleuth's landlord. Surely it was inconceivable that this gentle, mild-mannered gentleman could be the monster of cruelty and cunning that Bunting had now for the terrible space of 4 days believed him to be. He tried to catch his wife's eye, but Mrs. Bunting was looking away, staring into vacancy. She still, of course, wore the bonnet and cloak in which she had just been out to do her marketing. Daisy was already putting on her hat and coat. "Well?" said Mr. Sleuth. Then Mrs. Bunting turned, and it seemed to his landlady that he was looking at her threateningly. "Well?" "Yes, sir. We'll come in a minute," she said dully. End of chapter 25. Recording by Leanne Howlett. Chapter 26 of The Lodger. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Leanne Howlett. The Lodger by Marie Belloc Lowndes. Chapter 26. Madame Tussaud's had hitherto held pleasant memories for Mrs. Bunting. In the days when she and Bunting were courting, they often spent there part of their afternoon out. The butler had an acquaintance, a man named Hopkins, who was one of the waxworks staff, and this man had sometimes given him passes for self and lady. But this was the first time Mrs. Bunting had been inside the place since she had come to live almost next door, as it were, to the big building. They walked in silence to the familiar entrance, and then, after the ill-assorted trio had gone up the great staircase and into the first gallery, Mr. Sleuth suddenly stopped short. The presence of those curious, still, waxen figures which suggest so strangely death and life seemed to surprise and affright him. Daisy took quick advantage of the lodger's hesitation and unease. "Oh, Ellen," she cried, "do let us begin by going into the Chamber of Horrors. I've never been in there. Old Aunt made Father promise he wouldn't take me the only time I've ever been here. But now that I'm 18, I can do just as I like. Besides, Old Aunt will never know." Mr. Sleuth looked down at her, and a smile passed for a moment over his worn, gaunt face. "Yes," he said, "let us go into the Chamber of Horrors. That's a good idea, Miss Bunting. I've always wanted to see the Chamber of Horrors." They turned into the great room in which the Napoleonic relics were then kept, and which led into the curious, vault-like chamber where waxen effigies of dead criminals stand grouped in wooden docks. Mrs. Bunting was at once disturbed and relieved to see her husband's old acquaintance, Mr. Hopkins, in charge of the turnstile admitting the public to the Chamber of Horrors. "Well, you are a stranger," the man observed genially. "I do believe that this is the very first time I've seen you in here, Mrs. Bunting, since you was married." "Yes," she said, "that is so. And this is my husband's daughter, Daisy. I expect you've heard of her, Mr. Hopkins. And this," she hesitated a moment, "is our lodger, Mr. Sleuth." But Mr. Sleuth frowned and shuffled away. Daisy, leaving her stepmother's side, joined him. Two, as all the world knows, is company. Three is none. Mrs. Bunting put down 3 sixpences. "Wait a minute," said Hopkins. "You can't go into the Chamber of Horrors just yet. But you won't have to wait more than 4 or 5 minutes, Mrs. Bunting. It's this way, you see. Our boss is in there showing a party round." He lowered his voice. "It's Sir John Burney. I suppose you know who Sir John Burney is." "No," she answered indifferently. "I don't know that I ever heard of him." She felt slightly, oh, very slightly, uneasy about Daisy. She would have liked her stepdaughter to keep well within sight and sound, but Mr. Sleuth was now taking the girl down to the other end of the room. "Well, I hope you never will know him, not in any personal sense, Mrs. Bunting." The man chuckled. "He's the Commissioner of Police, the new one. That's what Sir John Burney is. One of the gentlemen he's showing round our place is the Paris police boss, whose job is on all fours, so to speak, with Sir John's. The Frenchie has brought his daughter with him, and there are several other ladies. Ladies always likes horrors, Mrs. Bunting. That's our experience here. Oh, take me to the Chamber of Horrors. That's what they say the minute they gets into this here building."
Mrs. Bunting looked at him thoughtfully. It occurred to Mr. Hopkins that she was very wan and tired. She used to look better in the old days, when she was still in service, before Bunting married her.
"Yes," she said, "that's just what my stepdaughter said just now. Oh, take me to the Chamber of Horrors. That's exactly what she did say when we got upstairs."
A group of people, all talking and laughing together, were advancing from within the wooden barrier toward the turnstile. Mrs. Bunting stared at them nervously. She wondered which of them was the gentleman with whom Mr. Hopkins had hoped she would never be brought into personal contact. She thought she could pick him out among the others. He was a tall, powerful, handsome gentleman with a military appearance. Just now he was smiling down into the face of a young lady. "Monsieur Barbaroux is quite right," he was saying in a loud, cheerful voice. "Our English law is too kind to the criminal, especially to the murderer. If we conducted our trials in the French fashion, the place we have just left would be very much fuller than it is today. A man of whose guilt we are absolutely assured is oftener than not acquitted, and then the public taunt us with another undiscovered crime."
"Do you mean, Sir John, that murderers sometimes escape scot-free? Take the man who has been committing all these awful murders this last month. I suppose there's no doubt he'll be hanged, if he's ever caught, that is."
Her girlish voice rang out, and Mrs. Bunting could hear every word that was said. The whole party gathered round, listening eagerly. "Well, no," he spoke very deliberately. "I doubt if that particular murderer ever will be hanged."
"You mean that you'll never catch him?" The girl spoke with a touch of airy impertinence in her clear voice.
"I think we shall end by catching him, because—" He waited a moment, then added in a lower voice, "Now don't give me away to a newspaper fellow, Miss Rose, because now I think we do know who the murderer in question is." Several of those standing nearby uttered expressions of surprise and incredulity.
"Then why don't you catch him?" cried the girl indignantly.
"I didn't say we knew where he was. I only said we knew who he was, or rather, perhaps I ought to say that I personally have a very strong suspicion of his identity."
Sir John's French colleague looked up quickly. "De Leipzig and Liverpool man?" he said interrogatively. The other nodded. "Yes, I suppose you've had the case turned up?"
Then, speaking very quickly, as if he wished to dismiss the subject from his own mind and from that of his auditors, he went on. "Four murders of the kind were committed 8 years ago, two in Leipzig, the others just afterwards in Liverpool, and there were certain peculiarities connected with the crimes which made it clear they were committed by the same hand. The perpetrator was caught, fortunately for us, red-handed, just as he was leaving the house of his last victim, for in Liverpool the murder was committed in a house. I myself saw the unhappy man. I say unhappy, for there is no doubt at all that he was mad." He hesitated and added in a lower tone, "suffering from an acute form of religious mania. I myself saw him, as I say, at some length. But now comes the really interesting point. I have just been informed that a month ago this criminal lunatic, as we must of course regard him, made his escape from the asylum where he was confined. He arranged the whole thing with extraordinary cunning and intelligence, and we should probably have caught him long ago, were it not that he managed, when on his way out of the place, to annex a considerable sum of money in gold, with which the wages of the asylum staff were about to be paid. It is owing to that fact that his escape was, very wrongly, concealed." He stopped abruptly, as if sorry he had said so much, and a moment later the party were walking in Indian file through the turnstile, Sir John Burney leading the way. Mrs. Bunting looked straight before her. She felt, so she expressed it to her husband later, as if she had been turned to stone. Even had she wished to do so, she had neither the time nor the power to warn her lodger of his danger, for Daisy and her companion were now coming down the room, bearing straight for the Commissioner of Police. In another moment Mrs. Bunting's lodger and Sir John Burney were face to face. Mr. Sleuth swerved to one side. There came a terrible change over his pale, narrow face. It became discomposed, livid with rage and terror. But, to Mrs. Bunting's relief—yes, to her inexpressible relief—Sir John Burney and his friend swept on. They passed Mr. Sleuth and the girl by his side, unaware, so it seemed to her, that there was anyone else in the room but themselves. "Hurry up, Mrs. Bunting," said the turnstile keeper. "You and your friends will have the place all to yourselves for a bit." From an official he had become a man,
and it was the man and Mr. Hopkins that gallantly addressed pretty Daisy Bunting. "It seems strange that a young lady like you should want to go in and see all those horrible frights," he said jestingly. "Mrs. Bunting, may I trouble you to come over here for a moment?" The words were hissed rather than spoken by Mr. Sleuth's lips. His landlady took a doubtful step towards him. "A last word with you, Mrs. Bunting." The lodger's face was still distorted with fear and passion. "Do not think to escape the consequences of your hideous treachery. I trusted you, Mrs. Bunting, and you betrayed me. But I am protected by a higher power, for I still have much to do." Then his voice sinking to a whisper, he hissed out, "Your end will be bitter as wormwood and sharp as a two-edged sword. Your feet shall go down to death, and your steps take hold on hell." Even while Mr. Sleuth was muttering these strange, dreadful words, he was looking round, glancing this way and that, seeking a way of escape. At last his eyes became fixed on a small placard placed above a curtain. "Emergency exit" was written there. Mrs. Bunting thought he was going to make a dash for the place, but Mr. Sleuth did something very different. Leaving his landlady's side, he walked over to the turnstile. He fumbled in his pocket for a moment, and then touched the man on the arm. "I feel ill," he said, speaking very rapidly. "Very ill indeed. It is the atmosphere of this place. I want you to let me out by the quickest way. It would be a pity for me to faint here, especially with ladies about." His left hand shot out and placed what he had been fumbling for in his pocket on the other's bare palm. "I see there's an emergency exit over there. Would it be possible for me to get out that way?" "Well, yes, sir, I think so." The man hesitated. He felt a slight, a very slight, feeling of misgiving. He looked at Daisy, flushed and smiling, happy and unconcerned, and then at Mrs. Bunting. She was very pale, but surely her lodger's sudden seizure was enough to make her feel worried. Hopkins felt the half-sovereign pleasantly tickling his palm. The Paris prefect of police had given him only half a crown. Mean, shabby foreigner. "Yes, sir, I can let you out that way," he said at last, "and perhaps when you're standing out in the air on the iron balcony you'll feel better. But then, you know, sir, you'll have to come round to the front if you wants to come in again, for those emergency doors only open outward." "Yes, yes," said Mr. Sleuth hurriedly. "I quite understand. If I feel better, I'll come in by the front way and pay another shilling. That's only fair." "You needn't do that if you'll just explain what happened here." The man went and pulled the curtain aside and put his shoulder against the door. It burst open, and the light, for a moment, blinded Mr. Sleuth. He passed his hand over his eyes. "Thank you," he muttered. "Thank you. I shall get all right out there." An iron stairway led down into a small stable-yard, of which the door opened into a side street. Mr. Sleuth looked round once more. He really did feel very ill, ill and dazed. How pleasant it would be to take a flying leap over the balcony railing and find rest, eternal rest, below. But no, he thrust the thought, the temptation, from him. Again a convulsive look of rage came over his face. He had remembered his landlady. How could the woman whom he had treated so generously have betrayed him to his arch-enemy, to the official, that is, who had entered into a conspiracy years ago to have him confined, him, an absolutely sane man with a great avenging work to do in the world, in a lunatic asylum. He stepped out into the open air, and the curtain, falling to behind him, blotted out the tall, thin figure from the little group of people who had watched him disappear. Even Daisy felt a little scared. "He did look bad, didn't he, now?" She turned appealingly to Mr. Hopkins. "Yes, that he did, poor gentleman. Your lodger, too?" He looked sympathetically at Mrs. Bunting. She moistened her lips with her tongue. "Yes," she repeated dully, "my lodger." End of chapter 26. Recording by Leanne Howlett. Chapter 27 of The Lodger. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Leanne Howlett. The Lodger by Marie Belloc Lowndes. Chapter 27. In vain Mr. Hopkins invited Mrs. Bunting and her pretty stepdaughter to step through into the Chamber of Horrors. "I think we ought to go straight home," said Mr. Sleuth's landlady decidedly, and Daisy meekly assented. Somehow the girl felt confused, a little scared by the lodger's sudden disappearance. Perhaps this unwonted feeling of hers was induced by the look of stunned surprise, and yes, pain, on her stepmother's face. Slowly they made their way out of the building, and when they got home it was Daisy who described the strange way Mr. Sleuth had been taken. "I don't suppose he'll be long before he comes home," said Bunting heavily, and he cast an anxious, furtive look at his wife. She looked as if stricken in a vital part. He saw from her face that there was something wrong, very wrong indeed. The hours dragged on. All three felt moody and ill at ease. Daisy knew there was no chance that young Chandler would come in today. About 6 o'clock Mrs. Bunting went upstairs. She lit the gas in Mr. Sleuth's sitting-room and looked about her with a fearful glance. Somehow everything seemed to speak to her of the lodger. There lay her Bible and his concordance, side by side on the table, exactly as he had left them, when he had come downstairs and suggested that ill-starred expedition to his landlord's daughter. She took a few steps forward, listening the while anxiously for the familiar sound of the click in the door which would tell her that the lodger had come back, and then she went over to the window and looked out. What a cold night for a man to be wandering about, homeless, friendless, and, as she suspected with a pang, with but very little money on him. Turning abruptly, she went into the lodger's bedroom and opened the drawer of the looking-glass. Yes, there lay the much-diminished heap of sovereigns, if only he had taken his money out with him. She wondered painfully whether he had enough on his person to secure a good night's lodging, and then suddenly she remembered that which brought relief to her mind. The lodger had given something to that Hopkins fellow, either a sovereign or half a sovereign, she wasn't sure which. The memory of Mr. Sleuth's cruel words to her, of his threat, did not disturb her overmuch. It had been a mistake, all a mistake. Far from betraying Mr. Sleuth, she had sheltered him, kept his awful secret as she could not have kept it had she known, or even dimly suspected, the horrible fact with which Sir John Burney's words had made her acquainted, namely that Mr. Sleuth was victim of no temporary aberration, but that he was, and had been for years, a madman, a homicidal maniac. In her ears there still rang the Frenchman's half-careless yet confident question, "De Leipzig and Liverpool, man?" Following a sudden impulse, she went back into the sitting-room, and taking a black-headed pen out of her bodice, stuck it amid the leaves of the Bible. Then she opened the book and looked at the page the pen had marked. "My tabernacle is spoiled, and all my cords are broken. There is none to stretch forth my tent any more and to set up my curtains." At last, leaving the Bible open, Mrs. Bunting went downstairs, and as she opened the door of her sitting-room, Daisy came towards her stepmother. "I'll go down and start getting the lodger's supper ready for you," said the girl good-naturedly. "He's certain to come in when he gets hungry. But he did look upset, didn't he, Ellen? Right down bad, that he did." Mrs. Bunting made no answer. She simply stepped aside to allow Daisy to go down. "Mr. Sleuth won't never come back no more," she said somberly, and then she felt both glad and angry at the extraordinary change which came over her husband's face. Yet perversely that look of relief, of right-down joy, chiefly angered her, and tempted her to add, "That's to say, I don't suppose he will." And Bunting's face altered again. The old, anxious, depressed look, the look it had worn the last few days, returned. "What makes you think he mayn't come back?" he muttered. "Too long to tell you now," she said. "Wait till the child's gone to bed." And Bunting had to restrain his curiosity. And then, when at last Daisy had gone off to the back room where she now slept with her stepmother, Mrs. Bunting beckoned to her husband to follow her upstairs. Before doing so he went down the passage and put the chain on the door, and about this they had a few sharp whispered words. "You're never going to shut him out?" she expostulated angrily beneath her breath. "I'm not going to leave Daisy down here with that man perhaps walking in any minute. Mr. Sleuth won't hurt Daisy, bless you. Much more likely to hurt me." And she gave a half-sob. Bunting stared at her. "What do you mean?" he said roughly. "Come upstairs and tell me what you mean." And then, in what had been the lodger's sitting-room, Mrs. Bunting told her husband exactly what it was that had happened. He listened in heavy silence. "So you see," she said at last, "you see, Bunting, that 'twas me that was right after all. The lodger was never responsible for his actions. I never thought he was, for my part." And Bunting stared at her ruminatingly. "Depends on what you call responsible," he began argumentatively. "But she would have none of that. I heard the gentleman say myself that he was a lunatic," she said fiercely, and then dropping her voice. "A religious maniac, that's what he called him." "Well, he never seemed so to me," said Bunting stoutly. "He simply seemed to me centric, that's all he did, not a bit madder than many I could tell you of." He was walking round the room restlessly, but he stopped short at last. "And what do you think we ought to do now?" Mrs. Bunting shook her head impatiently. "I don't think we ought to do nothing," she said. "Why should we?" And then again he began walking round the room in an aimless fashion that irritated her. "If only I could put out a bit of supper for him somewhere where he would get it. And his money, too. I hate to feel it's in there." "Don't you make any mistake. He'll come back for that," said Bunting with decision. But Mrs. Bunting shook her head. She knew better. "Now," she said, "you go off up to bed. It's no use us sitting up any longer." And Bunting acquiesced. She ran down and got him a bedroom candle. There was no gas in the little back bedroom upstairs, and then she watched him go slowly up. Suddenly he turned and came down again. "Ellen," he said in an urgent whisper, "if I was you, I'd take the chain off the door, and I'd lock myself in. That's what I'm going to do. Then he can sneak in and take his dirty money away." Mrs. Bunting neither nodded nor shook her head. Slowly she went downstairs, and there she carried out half of Bunting's advice. She took, that is, the chain off the front door. But she did not go to bed, neither did she lock herself in. She sat up all night, waiting. At 7:30 she made herself a cup of tea, and then she went into her bedroom. Daisy opened her eyes. "Why, Ellen," she said, "I suppose I was that tired and slept so sound that I never heard you come to bed or get up. Funny, wasn't it?" "Young people don't sleep as light as do old folks," Mrs. Bunting said sententiously. "Did the lodger come in after all? I suppose he's upstairs now?" Mrs. Bunting shook her head. "It looks as if 'twould be a fine day for you down at Richmond," she observed in a kindly tone. And Daisy smiled, a very happy, confident little smile. That evening Mrs. Bunting forced herself to tell young Chandler that their lodger had, so to speak, disappeared. She and Bunting had thought carefully over what they would say, and so well did they carry out their program, or what is more likely, so full was young Chandler of the long happy day he and Daisy had spent together, that he took their news very calmly. "Gone away, has he?" he observed casually. "Well, I hope he paid up all right." "Oh, yes, yes," said Mrs. Bunting hastily. "No trouble of that sort." And Bunting said shamefacedly, "Aye, the lodger was quite an honest gentleman, Joe, but I feel worried about him. He was such a poor gentle chap, not the sort of man one likes to think of as wandering about by himself." "You always said he was centric," said Joe thoughtfully. "Yes, he was that," said Bunting slowly. "Regular right down queer, little touched, you know, under the thatch." And as he tapped his head significantly, both young people burst out laughing. "Would you like a description of him circulated?" asked Joe good-naturedly. Mr. and Mrs. Bunting looked at one another. "No, I don't think so. Not yet a while, at any rate. 'Twould upset him awfully, you see." And Joe acquiesced. "You'd be surprised at the number of people who disappears and are never heard of again," he said cheerfully, and then he got up very reluctantly. Daisy, making no bones about it this time, followed him out into the passage and shut the sitting-room door behind her. When she came back she walked over to where her father was sitting in his easy-chair, and standing behind him she put her arms round his neck. Then she bent down her head. "Father," she said, "I've a bit of news for you." "Yes, my dear?" "Father, I'm engaged. Aren't you surprised?" "Well, what do you think?" said Bunting fondly. Then he turned round, and catching hold of her head, gave her a good hearty kiss. "What'll old aunt say, I wonder?" he whispered. "Don't you worry about old aunt," exclaimed his wife suddenly. "I'll manage old aunt. I'll go down and see her. She and I have always got on pretty comfortable together, as you knows well, Daisy."
"Yes," said Daisy a little wonderingly, "I know you have, Ellen."
Mr. Sleuth never came back, and at last, after many days and many nights had gone by, Mrs. Bunting left off listening for the click of the lock which she at once hoped and feared would herald her lodger's return. As suddenly and as mysteriously as they had begun, the Avenger murders stopped. But there came a morning in the early spring when a gardener, working in the Regent's Park, found a newspaper in which was wrapped, together with a half-worn pair of rubber-soled shoes, a long, peculiarly shaped knife. The fact, though of considerable interest to the police, was not chronicled in any newspaper, but about the same time a picturesque little paragraph went the round of the press concerning a small box full of sovereigns which had been anonymously forwarded to the governors of the Foundling Hospital. Meanwhile, Mrs. Bunting had been as good as her word about old aunt, and that lady had received the wonderful news concerning Daisy in a more philosophical spirit than her great niece had expected her to do. She only observed that it was odd to reflect that if gentlefolks leave a house in charge of the police, a burglary is pretty sure to follow, a remark which Daisy resented much more than did her Joe. Mr. Bunting and his Ellen are now in the service of an old lady, by whom they are feared as well as respected, and whom they make very comfortable. End of chapter 27. End of The Lodger. Recording by Leanne Howlett.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.